And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levin.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. The situation is dire in America. It just doesn't seem to get any worse. Trying to live with, the Bush Great Depression. We have Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Chairman, coming yesterday and saying that he doesn't think we're going to be out of recession until 2011. He's rising 8%. The car industry is falling apart. Obama, I think, very wisely decided not to have a car czar, the great last Bush idea on this. Foreclosures are up. President Obama did have a very interesting proposal to help Americans who are on the verge of foreclosure that he announced yesterday, and I'm going to talk about that during this hour. State budgets, well, they're in trouble too. See, states don't have the ability, the way the federal government does, to borrow money. They've got to, most of the time, basically just have a balanced budget. So with the decline in housing prices, the decline in property taxes, the decline in income taxes in general, because of all the Americans that are unemployed, well, states are cutting services. More than 40 out of 50 states are cutting services and payroll. 28 are cutting public health, at least. 22 at least are cutting aid to the elderly and the disabled. It just doesn't seem to give us any good news. But the only good news we have thus far is the Obama administration and the Democratic Congress signing on to a stimulus package that's supposed to help us get out of our Great Depression. And I want to talk about the stimulus package today with my guest. He is Chairman Frank Pallone, Congressman Doug Leon, state of New Jersey. He is the chairman of the Health Subcommittee of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Now, what that means is that Congressman Pallone is in charge of a lot of those very, very important health things that, you may not know who funds them, things like the NIH, National Institute of Health, that goes out and tries to find cures for cancer, or the Center for Disease Control that does such an amazing job to try to prevent AIDS and other contagious diseases. And what's interesting is that there's a lot of things hidden in the stimulus package that really go a long way toward public health. One of the things that the Republicans were complaining about was that the Democrats were sneaking some of their agenda in the stimulus package. And they thought it was a bad thing. But actually, I think it's quite a good thing, a lot of the things that they've put in, things like having your health care on computers, your health information, so that if you go to a new doctor and you don't remember what your doctor said 5 years ago, a lot of doctors, frankly, charge you to get your own file from that doctor. And so, you have files, you move, and then there's another doctor's file, and most people don't pay to get all their files together. The idea of putting it all on one place, you got to have protections for security, of course. But the idea of putting all of healthcare in one place so that people can go from doctors to doctor and actually have healthcare. Well, that is another provision in this bill. So I'm told now that Congressman Frank Pallone has joined us. Congressman Pallone, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks a lot. Good to be on the show.
Well, let me start with some of the health care provisions in the stimulus package, because I know
Sure.
you worked very hard on them, and frankly, they haven't gotten a lot of attention. Tell us what was in the stimulus package relating to health care.
Well, there were three main areas. One is that, as you know, with the recession, more and more people are unemployed. And when you're unemployed, you often or usually lose your health care. And, your income is such that, it dissipates or disappears. So a lot of people now are eligible for some of the government programs like Medicaid that they wouldn't normally be when they were working. And so and as you said, states increasingly don't have the money to pay for these programs because it's a match. The state has to put up a certain percentage of the money to pay for people on Medicaid. So one of the things we did is we, about $87 billion of that, you know, $750 billion package is money that goes to the states to help them pay, and defray the cost of Medicaid. So that's one thing. The second thing.
You said $87 billion?
87, yeah. In New Jersey alone, it's over $2 billion. In New Jersey alone, it's over $2 billion.
That's separate in addition to the $54 billion that's going directly to state governments to spend.
Right, separate from that state fund that you're mentioning. So it's a big chunk of the stimulus. And, you know, it is obviously has a stimulative effect because, you know, you hire doctors and health care aides and nurses and everybody to take care of these people who, you know, would normally not be insured. The other thing is if you are eligible for COBRA, in other words, if you lose your job and you're eligible for COBRA, you know, right now, until this bill passed, you had to pay most of that cost yourself. And what we do is we pay 65% of the cost of your COBRA.
Why don't you explain to our listeners, Chairman Pallone, what COBRA is? I don't think they all know.
Well, COBRA is, in other words, for a lot of people that work, if they lose their job, they can continue with the health insurance that they have through their employer by paying the value of it up front. So in other words, right now, like say you have Blue Cross Blue Shield and you're working, you know, in an auto plant and all of a sudden you lose your job. Well, the federal law allows you or requires that, that existing policy, whatever policy you had, will continue for a certain period of time, but you have to pay the cost of it. You have to pay the full premium. Your employer used to pay it and you paid part of it. Now you're paying the whole thing essentially. So it's not affordable. In other words, if you lose your job, you know, unless you have a lot of money in the bank or savings or somebody else is going to, you know, help you, you know, you don't have the money to pay that premium. So, you know, that's an option now where 65% of that cost will be picked up by the federal government. That's the second thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing is what you mentioned, which is the health information technology. There's about $20 billion that goes to doctors and hospitals so they can upgrade their technology, which generally means, you know, that they computerize their records or do other things with medication to prevent errors. I mean, it's not unusual to go into a doctor's office. I've certainly been to some. They don't even have computers, and it's all paper. And, you know, that makes it difficult. You end up filling out a mean forms. I went to one with my son a couple of weeks ago where I actually went into the reception area and filled out the form and then went back in the waiting room, and they asked me to fill out the same form again. I said, well, why can't you use the one that I filled out 5 minutes ago? Oh, well, that's too complicated. So, I mean, you know, a lot of these doctors' offices and hospitals are just not, they need to be upgraded so that they're, you know, computer literate. I hate to say it, but it's true.
Well, I understand that, Congressman, but I mean, doctors and hospitals, maybe I have a little more sympathy for hospitals, but these are highly paid institutions. You know, why haven't they done this? Isn't it in their benefit that they act more efficiently?
It's not the case, Mark. I mean, right now in New Jersey, a lot of hospitals are closing, and there are very few that are in the black, so to speak. We have, I mean, if you're a hospital now, like, for example, in Ocean County, you know, there's a large senior community, right? In Ocean County, some of the hospitals are 80% Medicare dependent. In other words, 80% of the people that are using the hospital are using Medicare as their insurance. Well, Medicare only pays 80% of the cost of the hospital care. So, you know, you could be 10, and I'm not making this up, some in Ocean County are $10 million in the red because they are not getting an adequate reimbursement rate. So they're not in a position to do anything, really, because they're in debt at the end of the year.
Chairman Pallone, let me ask you this, and it relates to really the larger issues, health care issues, but beyond the stimulus package. President Obama today is in Canada. And I can't help but look at the Canadian healthcare system, which costs less than half per Canadian citizen what ours costs per American citizen. And they cover everybody, whereas we have 40 million Americans that are still not insured. Does what you did in the stimulus package move us closer to universal healthcare?
No, I can't say that. It's certainly a down payment on it in the sense that You know, we're trying to cover more people with Medicaid, and we're trying to do, you know, more with COBRA, you know, the way I described. But remember, we're still operating, with the exception of those few government programs like Medicare, we're still operating primarily with private insurance. And even what President Obama has suggested as health care reform, and what I support, and what we're going to try to move on this year in my subcommittee, is all private. We're not talking about a single-payer system. And the reason for that...
But you are talking about the government being part of the system, right? I mean, people can keep their private insurance or
move...
Well,
in the following sense. Basically, there are three parts to it, Mark, and I don't know how much time, but I'll try to be brief.
No, go ahead.
One part is to upgrade the existing government programs like Medicare and Medicaid, because the reimbursement rate is not adequate. They don't cover a lot of things. People have to put a lot of money out of pocket, even if they're on Medicare or Medicaid or SCHIP. So that's one part of it. Those are government programs, but they're the existing government programs, and their eligibility isn't being changed. It's just that they would maybe have a higher reimbursement rate for the providers, and that they would cover more things. But we're not changing the eligibility, who qualifies. The second thing is to take the traditional employer-sponsored insurance, which has really been reduced. About 15 years ago, maybe 68% of the people got their health insurance through their employer. Now it's about 50%. So a big part of the uninsured are people who work but don't get their employer to cover their health insurance. So we would use the tax code to try to change that so more employers provide health insurance. And then the third thing is a sort of a national insurance pool, like the federal employees, where people who can't get health insurance on the job or don't qualify for Medicare, for example, rather than going out on the private market where it's unaffordable, they would be part of a national insurance pool where the government would offer different kinds of private health insurance and you know, negotiate those packages as they do with federal employees so they bring the cost down, and they have a lot of people, so it's a large insurance pool. And that would be the third way to try to get towards universal care. So it's an effort to get towards universal care, and I think it would work towards covering almost everyone. But it's not a single payer. It's not a Canadian system where the government's actually, you know, substituting for private insurance.
I understand that, but I guess what I'm trying to figure out, and I am not an expert in healthcare, you are, which is why I'm asking this question, is I did read in the Washington Post, and it was, I think, it may have been a columnist, and it may have been wrong, and you may feel free to dispute these figures, but he said that Canada pays half of what Americans pay.
Mark, there's
and
no
yet
question
they cover everyone.
Single payer, Mark, a single-payer system would be better. The Canadian system would certainly be an improvement on what we have, but politically there's no way to do it. I mean, when we were passing SCHIP 2 weeks ago, you know, which was my bill, to expand the SCHIP program for kids and cover another 4 million kids, a totally private-based system where the federal government is just giving the states money so they can give kids private insurance, right? Republican leadership in the House was screaming that this was a government-run health care system. So, I mean, it's the ideology. You can't sell single-payer because people think that they're going to lose their insurance and the government's going to run the show and it's communism and... You know, that's the problem. There's no way to politically do that. So we're just trying to build on the existing system and come up with ways of using private insurance to cover as many people as possible. Is that a better way to do things? I don't think so. But it's the only one you can sell politically. I mean, you know, you still got to get the votes, and the votes aren't going to
be there. Well, let me ask you this, Congressman. You know, sometimes you can get to a more perfect system by getting things piecemeal. COBRA was something that I think Bill Clinton started, the idea that you could transfer your health care from one to the other. Do you think that the provisions that you put in the stimulus package move us toward a single-payer system, both in terms of including more people and in terms of saving money? Because after all, that's the real goal here. It's not just to include everyone, which is a nice moral goal, but also to save money. Health care, frankly, is one of the reasons why the cards are, you know.
Mark, to be honest, what's in the stimulus is strictly a response to the recession. In other words, the reality that a lot of people are going to need Medicaid and the states need help in paying for it, that a lot of people lose their jobs and can't afford the COBRA. It's not, it doesn't move in that direction. It's just a response to the recession, basically.
But you said that you and your committee are going to move us toward that direction.
Well,
right?
What we would like to do next, and, you know, you're probably going to hear from the president more on this next week and beyond, is we'd like to move to that, you know, three-part, you know, health care reform that I mentioned to you, which basically Obama espoused during his campaign. But it's, you know, it's going to cost money, and it probably isn't something we can do overnight. But that is the goal, to, you know, to move towards universal care with by doing the things that I mentioned.
Do you think that'll happen in calendar year 2009?
That's the goal. The only problem we have is that, you know, all this costs money. If you want to give tax breaks to employers, or you want to set up a national insurance pool, you know, a lot of employers are going to need some major help. And the people that are in the national insurance pool, some will be able to afford it, but some are going to need a subsidy. So you have to come up with a way to pay for it. And in the
Let me ask you about the health information technology. One of the concerns, and I think it's a fair concern, is that if all your medical records are computerized, that the wrong people will have access to that. If I have a pre-existing condition and I don't want to be denied insurance, or if I have someone who really has no right to know my health record, maybe an employer or a landlord or something like that, what protections are in the system to protect our health care records so they're only for us and our doctors and not for all the other people with prying eyes?
Well, there are protections in there, privacy protections, that basically say what you're saying, and there's strong penalties if someone violates it and uses it for some other purpose. I think that there's always the risk that, you know, someone will violate it, as there is with anything. But I think that the protections and the penalties and the fines for breaches are pretty strong. And, so hopefully there won't be, a lot of breaches or, you know, a lot of, mistakes
are there
made.
Criminal penalties,
still a possibility,
or fines? What are some of those penalties? I mean, how severe are they?
Oh, they get pretty severe. I mean, I could actually, you know, I don't know if I have them actually in front of me here.
Just give me an idea. Can someone go to jail for it?
Oh, yeah. No, it's possible.
Okay.
I mean, there are fines, and there's even situations where it's illegal and you could end up with a jail term. But I don't have it in front of me, Mark, so I couldn't give it to you specifically.
Let me ask you also, and also I do want people to call in, 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366, and ask your questions as well. But one of the things that I know was definitely increased in terms of the health care in the stimulus package was money going to places like NIH, the National Institute of Health, the CDC, the Center
right.
for Disease Control, the Food and Drug Administration, and I'm told you played a major role in that.
Yes, and what we're trying to do, just so you know, because I think it's important, we have some, what we're trying to do as part of healthcare reform, and some of this is actually in the stimulus, is to move towards preventative medicine, wellness programs, also what we call comparative effectiveness research. I know that sounds like a wordy thing, but basically what that says is that there would be research done to show whether certain methods of doing things, whether it's an operation or use of certain drugs, are comparatively effective in terms of their cost. In other words, whether
that's important.
Or not. Yeah, it's very important.
I mean, you don't want to do an expensive drug when a cheap drug will do. I mean, it's
exactly. And so there's I mean, there's like $1 billion for a new prevention and wellness fund. There's $1 billion. For comparative effectiveness research to do this kind of evaluation of the effectiveness of different kinds of services and treatment options. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that in the long run will save money and provide for better quality that haven't really been a lot of attention hasn't been paid to them in the past. So, you know, these are some of the things we're trying to move towards the future in terms of reform.
Under the Bush administration, one of the, in my view, one of the worst bills they did was the prescription drug benefit, where they gave a lot of subsidies to pharmaceutical companies. And then the worst part of that bill, at least in my view, was the fact that it didn't allow the United States government to negotiate with drug companies to try to get better prices, which is exactly what Canada does.
I
don't think there's anything about that in the stimulus package, is there?
No,
and what are
certainly,
the prospects
there isn't.
For that?
No, there isn't. But it's one of the things that we would be looking at, you know, as we move towards health care reform and universal coverage. you know, when I talked about sort of the first plank of that, meaning to, you know, reevaluate and make stronger programs like Medicare and Medicaid and SCHIP, and Medicare, you know, has a kind of a hole. We call it a donut hole right now, so that if the federal government spends so much money on your prescription drugs in the course of a year, then you get to the point where there's a gap, and until you spend a certain amount out of pocket, you don't get any more money from the federal government to pay for your drugs. It's called a donut hole. And that was basically put in because, you know, for budget reasons. So, you know, if you could negotiate prices and bring the cost of drugs down, you could probably use that money to fill that donut hole so there's no gap in coverage for seniors. I mean, that's one of the things that could be done to sort of upgrade Medicare, and, you know, one way of saving money that would allow you to improve the program.
In terms of all the overall stimulus package, of course, Republicans, at least in the House, not a single one voted for it. You only got 3 votes in the Senate, just enough to get rid of a filibuster, and they complained that it's all pork. My concern really is on the other side, expressed by economists like Paul Krugman, that it doesn't go far enough in an economy that, frankly, is really scary. I mean, the stock market dropped again yesterday. People's savings have been cut in half. You know, if George Bush had his way on Social Security, we wouldn't even have Social Security right now. Thank God he didn't get his way on that. Are we going to need another stimulus package in the future?
Well, you know, again, this kind of goes back to, in some ways, our discussion about single-payer Canadian versus, you know, private insurance. You know, the president and the Congress can only do what's politically feasible. And, yes, I would have liked a larger stimulus package. I would have also liked a package that put more emphasis on spending money for, you know, infrastructure, schools, highways, hospitals, rather than a lot of the tax cuts that were in it, because I don't know that the tax cuts are that stimulative. But we had to do what we could, and basically, you know, we had to get the 3 votes in the Senate, and so that meant a 700, you know, something billion-dollar package, not a trillion-dollar package, and it meant that, you know, like half of it would actually have to be, you know, tax cuts or tax incentives rather than just spending money on infrastructure. So, you know, we live with what we can. Should it have been bigger? Yes, but I don't think politically it could have gotten the votes.
Well, here's my question politically, and I'd love you just to give the lay of the land to my listeners here. In the House, I presume, but I'm just curious, that you actually would have the votes not to go bigger, to even maybe have single-payer health care. With the obviously, you're not going to have every Democrat on your side, but with the large Democratic majority in the House,
Not on health care. My experience, you know, I've been in Congress for 20 years, Mark, and I remember when Bill Clinton tried to, you know, put together a health care reform with universal coverage. And I just think that when you start attacking and saying that, you know, this is government-run socialism, whatever, the Harry and Louise commercials you may or may not remember,
it's very hard.
I don't think you could get a majority in the House.
Not even
the single-payer system now.
See, that's interesting to me. I knew the problems in the Senate with the filibuster, but you don't even think you have enough in the House. Many Democrats are afraid.
Many Democrats would not support that, right?
Interesting.
I would say.
Now, let me ask you, I know you're in the House, you're not in the Senate. What is your view on the fact that filibusters used to be an unusual occurrence? It used to be, you know, where people would stay up all night talking and you'd make them actually do the filibuster, and it was an unusual occurrence, and then you'd vote. Today, it seems that every bill in the Senate is a filibuster.
It's
you hear on the news.
System. Mark, I think it's a total abuse. I think that if, you know, Washington and Jefferson, you know, came back and saw that the Senate that they envisioned, you know, with a majority vote was now being requiring a 60-vote majority to pass any legislation, they would be outraged. I mean, that is not what
the majority leader Harry Reid.
The system is broken, I think.
Do you think that majority leader Harry Reid should make them do it the old-fashioned way, stay up all night and
talk all night, and at least make it hard? Yes, but I think that what happens in the Senate is that every senator realizes that, you know, if they get rid of the 60-vote rule, that their influence becomes less. So it kind of, you know, even though it makes sense for the good of the country, I think there's a certain amount of loss of power on, you know, the party collectively that's in the minority, or maybe on the individual senators that makes it so that they won't abolish the rule. But it's definitely being abused. It was never intended to apply to every piece of legislation. And it never was applied that way until relatively recently in the last decade or two. So it's
I have another systemic question. I know that there are a few, in fact, I only know of one, maybe you know of more, but exceptions to the filibuster rule.
Yeah, there is. I think for the budget or budget reconciliation or certain things there are, but not too many.
I don't know enough about what you can stick in a budget reconciliation bill. For example, could you stick in some of the health care things that you and I would both like to see in budget reconciliation?
For the most part, most things require the 60 votes. But it's definitely detrimental to the process, in my opinion. I mean, look, you know, we're not at the what was the example historically with the Polish parliament where everyone, you had to have a unanimous vote to pass everything, and so nothing ever got done, and Poland ended up disintegrating. I mean, you know, we're not there, but I mean, there's the danger that when you have these supermajority requirements, that, you know, it definitely makes it more difficult to get things done, and particularly when you need fast action because you have a recession or a situation that requires fast action. It makes it difficult, and I think it's non-responsive to the needs of the people. But it is
one other thing I wanted.
We could talk all we like, but it's not going to change.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about was President Obama's plan announced last night to help people who are under the threat of foreclosure. Did you see his speech in Arizona, and what did you think about it?
I didn't, but I read everything today in the papers. I didn't actually see his speech. I mean, I think it's great. I mean, this was one of the things that had to be accomplished and that we couldn't get the Bush administration to go along with. I mean, you have this huge problem with the housing crisis and mortgage foreclosures, people not being able to renegotiate or restructure their mortgages. I think this is going to go far towards helping people accomplish that. You know, we tried to do it in the TARP legislation, the bailout bill, back in October, but, you know, President Bush wouldn't include this in that. And now President Obama is, in fact, doing it. I think he's also has a provision in there where, you know, you can have loan modification in bankruptcy court, too, which is important as well. So between
the understanding is that that's going to require legislation out of Congress.
Yeah, I think that can part get of that passed. I think that can get passed because of what's happening and the realization that it's necessary. So between this, you know, refinancing that's available and the money that's the $75 billion and the loan modification in bankruptcy court, I think this would go far towards helping, you know, a lot of people. They estimate what something like 7 million people would be helped by these changes.
Just in terms of the future on health care, virtually all of my listener base supports single payer. You support single payer. I support single payer. And not just because we want to see every American covered, not just for those moral reasons, but for financial reasons, too. Again, we can look at Canada and see that they're saving a lot of money. I understand that politically it's not there yet. I mean, I'm a pragmatist. I recognize what you can and can't do. What do you think needs to be done politically to get this country on the right track? I mean, I know Harry Truman tried and failed. I know Hillary Clinton tried and failed. What do you think has to be done? I mean, commercials, more examples of Canada? How do we convince the Americans?
I don't want to correct you, but Hillary's wasn't a, you know, Bill Clinton.
No, it wasn't single payer. No, you're right. It was on the way toward it. That's true.
But I think the political situation is largely linked to the fact that most people still have health insurance and like what they have. So in other words, you know, it's sort of like when you have a meeting and you talk about all the problems with the unemployed. I mean, New Jersey's about what, 7.5% unemployment? Well, what does that mean? That means 92.5% of the people are still employed. So, you know, you have to convince the 92.5% that they should go along with a program like the stimulus to help the 7.5 that are unemployed. Well, that's not always easy. Well, same thing is true with healthcare. If you know, if all but 40 or 50 million Americans have health insurance and pretty much like what they have, when you come up and say, I'm going to change this for you and give you single payer, they're like, whoa, you know, I don't know that that's going to be better for me. So I think that's
the
problem. In other words, it's a lot easier to say you're going to fill the gap with the current system than it is to come up with something totally new that affects everybody that already has good coverage.
My understanding is what President Obama suggested in the campaign was basically, I don't know, you can call it single-player light or private industry plus. The idea was that the government would be there, and if you want to go with United States government rather than Kaiser Permanente, you could make that choice so that people could
But you're
choose.
Really not, though. You know, and again, I want to, in my opinion, correctly categorize it. I mean,
okay.
The Republicans are leaders are saying that Obama's plan is government-run insurance, but it's not true. I mean, it's government involvement in the sense that, you know, the government's given out tax credits to help employers provide insurance, or the governor's setting up a national insurance pool or a health marketplace and, you know, trying to negotiate with different private insurance so that their coverage, you know, is less than what you'd pay on the individual market. But the government is only tinkering with the system. It's not running it. It's not providing the insurance, you know, like you would with a single-payer system. That's the difference.
One question that a caller asked, and I know you have to go. I only have you for the first half hour, so I won't put the caller on. But the caller, I've given the question from B in Ann Arbor, and she wants to know, is a lot of it the name? I mean, what if we called it Medicare for All instead of single-payer? A lot of people don't know what single-payer
is. No, I really think that the major glitch here is, and I find this true for everything, you know, whether we're talking unemployment, stimulus, schools, you know, if you like what you have, you don't, you know, you're not willing to change. And as long as most people have health insurance and are pretty much satisfied with it, they're afraid to move towards a new, a significantly different system that might impact them. That's what I think.
What if they have health care, but they think it's too expensive? I mean, I have health care, but I'd rather pay less for it, and I can look to Canada. Maybe most Americans don't look to Canada, but I can see that people with care pay less. I mean, it seems to me the argument is not cover the underinsured or the uninsured, but for the majority of Americans, you will pay less. Can you make that argument?
But they're also afraid that they're going to pay less and get and have worse coverage. They don't necessarily buy the idea that you can pay less and get as good coverage. I mean, I think that you can because so much is involved with the administrative costs and that, you know, the money that's basically paying, you know, for the administration or bureaucracy, if you will, of the private insurance. But, you know, I'm not making this up, Mark. I mean, I went through this with the, you know, during the Clinton era and I go through it every day. I mean, as I said, with SCHIP last couple of weeks, all we were doing was taking the program we already had for kids, not changing the eligibility. In fact, the eligibility was made less with the expanded bill. But there were a lot more people covered because there were a lot of people eligible that weren't enrolled. And we weren't doing anything except using a tobacco tax to pay to cover more kids with an existing program. And even that, you know, the Republican leadership said, oh, this government-run health care and we're on our way to socialism, and I mean, if you listen to the debate on the floor, you would think, you know, we were Karl Marx when trying to cover a few extra kids.
You know,
and,
Congressman,
that rhetoric,
I don't
you
doubt
know, was. It,
I don't doubt the Republicans. I don't doubt the Republicans. First of all, I don't think Republicans are the party of no and will call everything socialism. They called Barack Obama a socialist. Just before he had a very centrist government. So, no, I'm not looking for any kind of deliverance from the Republican Party. But it just
seems
to me that the Democrats do have a majority in the House and that in the Senate it's not impossible, as we've learned, to pick off a Arlen Specter or a Susan Collins or an Olympia Snowe. And really it's American people that have to be convinced. And because I think you could get the votes in Congress if the American people were convinced. And maybe
Of course, if you could get the public convinced, but that's what I'm saying would be very difficult because I went through it in the Clinton era, and I just had so many people come up to me and saying, look, I don't want to change my health insurance. I like what I have, and I don't want to change it, and I don't believe it's going to be as good and that I'm going to pay less. They just don't buy it. I don't know how you get over that. I haven't figured out a way.
Yeah, the only way I could think of is movies like Michael Moore's that actually show us the Canadian system and demonstrate that, guess what? I don't think most Americans realize that Canadians pay less than we do and cover more. I've already taken more than 30 minutes of your time. I really very, very much appreciate your coming on the show and explaining both what we have done and what we have difficulty doing.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Chairman Pallone. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, I'll take your calls, 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Barack Obama just made a big blunder. He signed an order to send 17,000 more U.S. troops to Afghanistan. And he did this even before his own internal review had barely begun, much less finished up. The 17,000 troops mark a nearly 50% increase in U.S. forces there. This isn't a surge, this is a splurge. But even this quantity is unlikely to contain the festering problem that is Afghanistan. The Karzai government Bush set up there is corrupt to the core, and U.S. bombing raids in Afghanistan last year killed more than 800 civilians, which hasn't endeared the local population to us. More U.S. troops will mean more civilian casualties and more local hatred toward the United States. Meanwhile, over the border in Pakistan, Islamic fundamentalists just got most of a province all to themselves. And Pakistan's intelligence agency is still playing footsie with those fundamentalists. This is a colossal mess. Doubling our troops, even quadrupling them, won't clean it up. Rather than rely on a military solution, Obama should call for regional negotiations and thereby isolate the reactionary Taliban and bring a unity government to Kabul. Afghanistan may not be Obama's Iraq. It actually may be his Vietnam. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
from Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I really enjoyed that conversation with Congressman Pallone, even though it was frustrating. But because I was glad to at least have him convey to all of you the frustration of pragmatism, of having to get a majority through both houses of Congress. When it comes to universal health care, I mean, the congressman and I and most of you agree that it's not just more compassionate. It's not just that it covers all Americans, but it's actually cheaper. I mean, that's the amazing thing about it. Sure, you can argue on liberal, compassionate grounds, and that's all well and good and important. But that's not enough to convince the majority of the American people. However, and the reason it is because, you know, of what Congressman Pallone said. You know, 92% have their health care and are working and are you know, maybe complaining a little bit about the cost, but basically happy with it. The trick is, I think, to convince the 90% that have health care. And I don't think it's that high. Let's see, 40 million Americans don't. Maybe it's almost 90. But how do you convince the 85%, 90% of Americans that have health care, that they'll do better off? And, you know, when I read in the newspaper, I knew the Canadians had a cheaper system than we do. I knew it. I didn't know it was half. Maybe I should have. I apologize that I didn't. But I was just reading an article about President Obama visiting Canada and talking about the fact that their single-payer universal health care system costs less than half per Canadian what Americans pay. And we Americans, I mean, let's face it, you know, not everyone has health care. And they're paying less than half. And you know the reason, of course. The reason is because we do provide, and I'm not saying we shouldn't, we do provide emergency health care for people who are in trouble. So we don't pay for a person's heart medication at, you know, $100 a month. Probably less if we can negotiate a better price. We don't pay $100 a month, and then a year later, the poor person without health care, walks into the emergency room and needs a quintuple heart bypass. Now, I'm not saying let the person die. I know that's the Republican answer. I realize we have to help the person, but the quintuple heart bypass, that might cost $75,000 when we could have saved $74,000 by paying the guy's heart medication. So I know why our health care is more expensive. Canada negotiates with the pharmaceutical companies. Canada acts like the biggest union in the world. Just as an employer can easily pick off employee after employee, pharmaceutical companies can easily pick off sick elderly person after sick person, right? But if the government, which after all is our representative, acts as one big union and negotiates better prices, well, then we can get better prices. So I know why Canada is cheaper. ELO points out in the chat room that emergency room care is only to stabilize people, not to cure them. Great. So we stabilize the heart patient and then send him out or her back on the streets, and then she doesn't have medication, and then she comes back with the next emergency. I do know emergency room treatment is more expensive than preventative care. So it seems to me that, I mean, Frank Pallone is right. We don't have the votes in Congress. I mean, I think sometimes you've got to simply tell the truth to people. You know, you want to do all these good things, and you don't have the votes. You may have heard my show yesterday with Congressman Van Hollen, and I had a caller call in, I think he was Gustav, and Gustav said, you know, why don't we just have universal health care? And I said, because we don't have the votes. That's true. As Congressman Pallone says, he ain't making that up. He's not. We don't have the votes. But we should have the votes. Because we have a strong Democratic majority in the House. We don't need a single Republican vote. I know there's a party of just say no, fine. And in the Senate, I think we could get 60. It'll take a while. Al Franken has to be seated. But we can't convince Arlen Specter or Susan Collins or Olympia Snow, one of them from those blue states, Heck, Otto Spector's term comes up in 2010. We can get another Democratic senator from Pennsylvania. We can get to 60. But at the end of the day, Democrats are uncertain about universal health care, and it's very simple to understand the reason. And Congressman Pallone pointed it out quite clearly. It's the devil you know versus the devil you don't know. I hate Kaiser Permanente. I hate my HMO. I pay them way too much money. They provide way less service than I want. But you know what? They're giving me some service, and I do get my medication, and I'm living, and I have health care, and I'm afraid of some newfangled government system that'll take it all away. And that's why, in my view, we've got to publicize Canada as much as possible. And, you know, I'll tell you, I liked very much Michael Moore's movie on healthcare. I did. I enjoyed it. But Moore is the wrong one to do it. Michael Moore is seen as a radical leftist by most of the American public. You could say the exact same things that he says. Don't bring in Cuba because, you know, a lot of people are understandably anti-Castro and it's communist and all that. Don't bring in Cuba. Just talk about Canada. Don't bring in France. People understand France is, you know, far more socialist than we are. Just talk about Canada. Most Americans don't think about Canada. It's our largest trading partner. It's where President Obama is today. They just don't think about Canada. Canada is our sweet uncle upstairs, and we really don't think Canadians think about us. You know, we're 300 million people. They're 25 million people. We don't think about them. But I'll tell you this about Canada. No American is afraid of Canada, right? I mean, Canada is seen as our friend, and it should be. It is our greatest ally. And it's not seen, I don't think, maybe a few Americans understand that Canada is, you know, to the left of us, a bit more socialist than we are. But I don't think most Americans think of Canada as any kind of radical country. Canada is not Cuba. Canada is not even France. Canada is our good friend to the north. I think we need a big campaign just to let Americans know how Canadian health care is. Not too much to ask, MoveOn.org. Not too much to ask President Obama or Congressman Pallone or Senator Barbara Boxer or any of the people I respect in Congress that support universal health care. Let people know what's going on in Canada. And also let people know that if they want more health care, they can buy it. Set up a Canadian standard for minimal health care, the kind that keeps you alive. And if you want liposuction and, you know, you want breast implants, even if you want, and it's a great surgery, I've had it, I highly recommend it, PRK, which gives you better sight. LASIK, actually, is the new standard. I mean, okay, those are voluntary procedures. Those should not be covered. If you want them, you can pay for them. No one is saying that rich people will not be able to get heart transplants and any of the very, very expensive medical treatments that only the rich can afford. But is it too much trouble to let people know what's going on in Canada? Lilo writes in the chat room, Mark, how about giving people a choice, private insurance, Medicare? Lilo, that's really my understanding of the Obama plan. That's largely what he's doing. Now, Congressman Pallone described it in more detail than I have. That's largely the Obama plan, but there is a problem with that, and it's one that the caller, and I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to get to be in Ann Arbor, but the caller was pointing out, and she pointed out that if you have people choosing private insurance or the government, because the government has to take everyone and private insurance does not, it's quite likely that those with pre-existing conditions, those who are more sick than others, you know, the 82-year-old person who's had five heart attacks and is on a lot of medication, they'll choose the government plan. And the 82-year-old person who's just fine and in terrific health, well, they may choose a private insurance plan that's cheaper. And certainly that's true for the 20-year-old. So there is a bit of moral hazard here, which is why I've got to be fair. I thought that Hillary Clinton's health care plan was better than Barack Obama's. I endorsed Barack Obama for president, but, you know, I recognize a good idea wherever it comes from, and Hillary Clinton was covering everyone. I liked her plan better, and I do agree that single-payer is the best way to go. Though I think B's right. Let's call it Medicare for all. Let's not call it single payer. One thing we could do is simply keep lowering the age for Medicare. You know, 65, bring it down to 60. A couple years later, bring it down to 55. Bring up children's health care to 20, 25. Soon you kind of meet in the middle. You sneak up on us, and suddenly we have universal health care. Bob lets me know that Medicare for All is the name of a bill that's there. I do want to talk about the foreclosure plan. I did see Obama's speech yesterday in Arizona, and I was quite impressed. I mean, this is something that should have been done for quite some time now. This is something that is really, again, simple. You know, Republicans accuse liberals of having bleeding hearts, of caring for people a bit too much, of practicing moral hazard. In other words, people who make bad investments, get in trouble, shouldn't be bailed out, right? They're fine with bailing out Wall Street. They're fine with bailing out the military. They just don't want to bail out ordinary people. But the irony is, as a pragmatist, and I am above all a pragmatist, that liberal solutions are cheaper than conservative ones. That's an important point, and one that should be repeated. Liberal solutions are cheaper than conservative ones. You would think covering everyone universal health care would be expensive. It's actually cheaper, as Canada has shown. When you throw everyone in the same basket and you get rid of all the administrative costs of private insurance. And the same is true with foreclosures. When you cram down the banks, when you force them to accept a little less so that people can stay in their home, yeah, it helps the people. It also helps the banks. It helps the banks to avoid foreclosure. And really the math is very simple on this one. Let's say you have a home that used to be worth $300,000 and you got a loan of $250,000 and now the home is worth $200,000 because of the collapse in the housing market. Now think about the bank's choices. They lower their loan from $250,000 to $200,000 or maybe even $250,000 to $220,000. You know, most people would stay in their homes to $220,000 just enough so they can afford to pay. And eventually, the bank is going to get their $220,000 back plus interest, probably more than the $250,000 that they loaned out to begin with. That's option one. That's the Obama option. It helps the people in the house, to be sure, but it also helps the banks. What's option two? Foreclosure. Do you know how expensive it is to do foreclosure? Well, first of all, I mean, you've got to force the people out of their house and deliver them notices and go to court and get all that done. Then there's the expense of, you know, putting someone's furniture all on their lawn, moving men, right, pushing these people out. Then you've got to sell the place at auction in a depressed market. Hey, the people couldn't afford their rent payments, their mortgage payments. They couldn't afford it because the economy's in distress, right? So now, their house, which is only worth $200,000, you want to sell it on the open market, but you're a bank. You don't have the time to wait like most people do to get the best price. You've got to sell it at open auction. And there are expenses. There's lawyers, there's the sheriff, there's the auctioneer. You'd be lucky to get $150,000. And then with all the expenses, $110,000 maybe, if you're lucky. So here's a bank that has a choice. Their choice is not to keep the original $250,000 loan. That's gone. No use crying over spilt milk. They can either keep up $220,000 plus interest and the people stay in their home, or they can get about $110,000, $130,000 maybe, $150,000. The banks make money when they don't foreclose, as long as the people who are staying in their home can pay it, which is why the Obama plan is brilliant. It says if you're a subprime, you know, person who never had a chance to make the loan in the first place, or you're an investor, and you're just going to foreclose a few months later, okay, we're not going to help you. And I'm fine with that. We shouldn't help people like that. But if you're just on the cusp, if you're struggling, if you need a little bit more, and you just can't afford it because, let's face it, the cost of your house went down and you're out of a job. We can help you over the hump and at the same time save the banks lots of money. So the next time a Republican says to you, oh, you know, liberal programs, they cost too much money. Liberal programs save money. At least good, pragmatic liberal programs do. And that's true in everything from universal health care to President Obama's foreclosure. I want to close today by talking about the rating of presidents. Historians have now rated George W. Bush. George W. Bush and the two people who were in charge of his White House, former Vice President Dick Cheney and Karl Rove, the Machiavellian, they always said, okay, nobody likes Bush now. Sure, he's had the highest disapproval rating of any president in all of polling history. But historians will vindicate the guy. Well, there's been a poll of 65 historians and observers of the presidency of all political backgrounds. And there are 42 presidents prior to President Obama. He's number 44 because we count Grover Cleveland twice since his terms weren't consecutive. But there were 42 total presidents before Obama. And Bush ranked 36th. 35 presidents were better than George Bush. And 6 presidents were rated lower than he. And you know what? I think that's really unfair. I think that's really unfair to some of the presidents that were rated lower than George Bush. I mean, William Henry Harrison, he was in office a month. He's the president who famously gave the longest inauguration speech ever, did so in the cold, without an overcoat on, caught pneumonia, died a month later. Now, historians rank him lower than George Bush? Why? Sure, he didn't do anything good, but he didn't do anything harmful either. He didn't get us into two wars based on intelligence that he cherry-picked. He didn't give us the Great Depression, right? He didn't cause, because he failed to regulate Wall Street firms, them to steal most of the money out of the economy. He didn't cause a worldwide depression. He didn't violate the Bill of Rights and put Americans in jail without trial and have secret prisons and torture people. Give William Henry Harrison a break. The worst thing he did was, you know, give too long a speech without an overcoat and catch pneumonia. We can rate him over 36. Andrew Johnson? They rated Bush over Johnson? Okay, Johnson was impeached. Okay, Johnson was drunk when Lincoln died and he accepted the presidency. But you know, Johnson was really trying to pursue Lincoln's ideas of being kind to the Confederacy and binding the country together. John F. Kennedy wrote a book saying that the person who saved Johnson from impeachment saved the country, Edmund G. Ross of Kansas. Okay, Johnson wasn't the best president in the world, but he's better than George W. Bush. We need to be fair. We need to rank George W. Bush appropriately. 36 is way too high. That's it for the Inside Scoop, but I do very, very much want to encourage everyone to listen to the show on Tuesday. Get your friends, get your family, let everyone know that the great Helen Thomas, veteran journalist dating back, I believe, to the Truman days, someone who's been part of the White House press corps since John F. Kennedy, I will have the honor and privilege to help Remaining Good to bring Helen Thomas on for a full one-hour interview. Let me tell you something. 60 minutes would kill for this. The McNeil Lehrer Hour, I think, would want this. I'm bringing her here, right here on the Inside Scoop. Don't miss Helen Thomas next Tuesday. This is Mark Levine signing off.